wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Sweet. Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Dear Science for this week. How are you going today?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, doing all right? That's great. We've got a pretty cool topic, a very topical one. That's a terrible word, a topical topic. we're talking about the Nobel Prizes that were announced in this past week, I think.
Yeah.
So there's three that we're talking about. There's four altogether that I think are science-y related. The physiology or medicine, the chemistry, the physics, there's the economic sciences, although maybe that's not science, actual science. I'm realizing that.
I can definitely see that.
Art and art instead of art.
And then they also have the literature and peace prize as well. But this is Dear Science.
So. I had forgotten about the economics one, which is the story is that economics, not maths, because Nobel had an issue with a mathematician or something to that effect. So it's always a big time of year for the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which give out the Nobel Prizes. Yeah. And yeah,
it's a very prestigious award, it
seems. Yes.
But I honestly don't know much about it beyond the Nobel Peace Prize. I thought that was like the main, that's the main one that I tend to hear about. I'm excited to hear about these science-y ones.
Yeah. So yeah, there, as you said, there's the medicine, economics, physics, chemistry, literature, and the Peace Prize. But the Peace Prize is the one that kind of gets the most press, particularly the last few years. But some really important discoveries and work has been recognised this year across like I've kind of gone for the more hardcore science ones of the lot. So if we start with, it's the Nobel Prize for Medicine or Physiology.
How are those different things? I don't
Well, they're pretty related and, you know, like, yeah. So I think, physiology, maybe it doesn't necessarily have to have medical implications, but it is, we're learning about the body and, you know, biology and stuff as well. So I think they've just used a broader term.
Nice. Yeah. Who won the prize for this one?
So it's shared. So you can kind of have a maximum of three people that they give these to. Mm-hmm. So this is shared by Mary Brunkow, Fred Ramsdale, and Shimon Sakaguchi. Mm-hmm. And it's for their discoveries concerning peripheral immune tolerance.
Okay.
So I was like, peripheral immune tolerance, right? What's that when it's at home?
I know what that is.
Trying to guess tolerances in physical tolerance or mental tolerance.
Immune tolerance.
Immune tolerance. There we go.
Yeah, it's basically about why does our immune system not attack us, right? So
we attack it. No, that's an uneducated guess.
So our immune system is amazing, right? Like it manages to identify pathogens and basically eradicate them without attacking our own cells. And so it was really, why is it not attacking our own cells? Like, what's going on here? And, you know, if you think about the sheer sort of diversity of things that can make us sick, like bacteria, viruses and all this sort of thing, they're all very different. And so our immune system is able to recognize these things and go attack them. And sometimes these things do actually start to, you could say they effectively try and camouflage themselves, like they have, their surfaces start to share some similarities with our own biologies, but how does our immune system know what to go after and what to leave alone?
So
that's what a lot of, what these three people did a lot of work on was figuring this out. So if we go back to the 1990s, because often these prizes are given for work that's been done a while ago, right? So the work has to have large significance and implications. And so often
this was just like if it was discovered in the last year.
No. Okay. So it's things that have, you know, they've been cooking for a while and we kind of recognize that they're significant.
Yeah. Of course, you've got to see that it has significance over a period of time.
Yeah. Okay. And so if we go back to the 1990s, we knew that there were these things called helper T cells and killer T cells. Mm-hmm. So we're just focusing on the T cells of our immune system for the story. Helper T cells, these are like the sentinels. These patrol our body. They discover the invaders and they basically alert our other immune cells saying, we have a threat. Come in, get rid of it. Killer T cells, as you can imagine from the name, it's their job to go in and eradicate infected cells. So if you've got cells that are infected with a virus, killer T cells come in and get rid of those cells.
Right.
And how these cells do this is on the surface of these T cells, there's these proteins or these receptors, and they basically act like a sensor. They're kind of like cruising around your body, and they're like, right, this is not supposed to be here. Something's gone wrong. And we have there's basically a large number of genes that get kind of randomly assorted to make these receptors to recognize these invading microorganisms. So that's why our immune system works quite well, because it can recognize a lot of different things as being invaders.
Yeah.
But like, why doesn't it, just by sheer number and chance, right? Sometimes that's going to like recognize our own body. And so like, why are we not attacking our own body? And so if we go back a little bit further in time, in the 1980s, they knew that if your T cells matured in the thing called a thymus. And they thought that, okay, well, what this thymus is doing is it runs a test on these T cells. And it says, are you going to attack the body or not? And if they were going to attack the body, then they killed the T cell.
Yeah.
But, you know, the experimental evidence wasn't really suiting this hypothesis. Like, they did this experiment where they used mice. They took the thymus out. And they hypothesized that, like, without this thymus, the mouse wasn't going to have as good an immune system, because it would be weak because it wasn't producing these T cells and testing them. And so you weren't having these T cells going around. But what happened is, if you took this thymus out 3 days after the mouse was born, its actual immune system just went nuts. It just went crazy, and it did start attacking itself, but the immune system was overdrive. So it wasn't really fitting the hypothesis they had. And this is where Sakaguchi was like, okay, there's something else going on in here, and did experiments to try and understand what this was. So he isolated helper T cells only, and you could tell what a helper T cell is because it has this protein CD4 on its surface, whereas killer cells have CD8. So you can separate them. And so he basically had some mice that were genetically identical to the mice that had taken the thymus out. They took the thymus out of some of the mice, injected them with these helper T cells, and it protected against the autoimmune disease. So by just putting these cells in, everything was fine. So he was like, okay, there's something about these T cells. And so he basically hypothesized that there must be not just helper T cells, but something else amongst the helper T cells. So there was kind of two types. And basically, he did a lot of work, isolated a population, and found what was called regulatory T cells. So they had a different protein. They had the CD4, but they also had CD25. And basically, what these regulatory T cells would do was they would go, don't attack this. It's your body. Leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And that. And so, but people were still skeptical. They were like, well, we're not so sure that this is the right idea yet. And so this is where the other two Nobel Prize winners come in, Brunkwell and Ramsdale. They worked for a company that was interested in developing pharmaceuticals against autoimmune diseases, because some of us do have autoimmune diseases, like, you know, like rheumatoid arthritis, allergies and that,
yeah, right.
Graves' disease and this sort of thing, where your body does misrecognize things. And so they had access to this mouse that was scaly, had scaly and flaky skin. It would have an extremely enlarged spleen and lymph glands, and it would live a few weeks. But it was only about half of the males that became diseased. The females could live with this mutation. So they could go, okay, this is X chromosome linked disease. They did some work, or some other people did work, and they found that these mice were sick basically because their T cells were attacking their own tissues. And so they did something that today would maybe not take quite as much effort as it did back then, and that's because it was molecular genetics. They were basically looking for the genes that were causing this disease, and so they had to look, they narrowed it down to X chromosome, which was 170 million base pairs. They narrowed that down to 500,000 base pairs, and then they were like, okay, basically, there's 20 potential genes could be linking to this. So then they had to compare healthy and diseased, and they found it. And then they also noticed that in humans there was a similar disease, and they looked to see if this gene mutation was there, and it was. And so they basically identified the mutation that was leading to bad regulatory T cells, and so it was more evidence for this regulatory T cells and this immune system response. And so that's how we basically learned more about the immune system and how regulatory T cells will stop our T cells from attacking our own body, but it also calms down your immune system. So if your immune system goes into overdrive to get rid of an invader, you don't want it to keep doing that. It needs to calm back down once it's done its job. And that's what these things do as well. And so this has led to the thing that you can start developing therapies and treatments for autoimmune diseases and such.
Wow, that's very impressive and very over my head. I'm now understand why they got a Nobel Prize for that one.
Yeah, if you ever start reading and watching YouTube videos about the immune system, it's just phenomenal. Like all these parts that have to work together.
And, right. What's this next one for chemistry? We've got metal organic framework.
Yes.
Now, what is that?
So the winners here were Susumi Kitagawa, Richard Robertson, and Omar Yagi. For the development of metal organic frameworks, otherwise known as a MOF. So if I say MOF, that's what it's a bit easier.
Yeah.
The Nobel or the Royal Swedish Academy of Science, who give out the Nobel Prizes, had a really nice analogy for this. They basically went, okay, if a real estate agent was describing a moth, they would go, it's an attractive, very spacious studio apartment specifically designed for your life as a water molecule.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? And so you can think of it as it's a block, a house full of studio apartments that can house these water molecules. And it's basically there, it's a molecular architecture that is very porous so that you can trap other molecules in it. So things like water or carbon dioxide or PFAS. So how it works is that you have metal ions are the cornerstones.
Mm-hmm.
And then these are linked by organic molecules. Organic molecules, just things that are carbon-based. And they form these large, these crystal structures that have large cavities. And then those cavities, you can design it such they will trap certain things. And so while they're really exciting is because you could use it for capturing carbon dioxide, which obviously has a lot of benefits. You can separate PFAS, the fluorinated substances, that like the forever chemicals from water, and you can make catalysts and all sorts of things. And so this is kind of cool in that it started with Richard Robinson, who's at University of Melbourne. So just across the ditch, 1974, he was doing some teaching. And if you've ever done any chemistry or you see a stereotypical chemistry lab, you think of the ball and stick models of a molecule, you know, where you'd have like the ball would be the atoms and you put the sticks together, it's the bonds. He was making these kits out of wood, but he had to get the workshop to drill some holes into the balls so that you could have the stick go in to make your ball and stick model. And when he was doing this, he actually had to mark them because for certain atoms, they bond in very specific ways. So an atom intrinsically has some sort of positional information about how it's going to bond.
Yeah.
And he looked at this and he was kind of like, what if instead of you were just using atoms, if you were using molecules, so molecules being a collection of atoms in a specific geometry. And he kind of sat on this idea for a while, and it wasn't until 1989 that he actually published a paper about it, where what he did was he'd basically thought about diamond, and diamond is just carbon. That's all diamond is. It's got a carbon will be bound to four other carbons in a tetrahedral shape, so like a pyramid, and there's just a series of these bonded together. So you get this really hard material because it's quite dense and that, and he thought, okay, well, what if you took a copper ion, because it will also bind to four different things in a similar arrangement, but instead of using just another atom like carbon or copper or such, we use actually a organic molecule. So now our copper ion basically got four arms, and those four arms then attached to another copper atom ion, sorry, and then another one. And so we got this structure that was quite porous, and he was like, this is really cool. A lot of the people were like, this is really cool. I think this will be really useful. Other people weren't so convinced because it wasn't very stable. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of fell apart. Then you had Kitagawa, who was in Japan, who a little bit after this, he's made his career off the finding the usefulness of the useless. Was how he's quoted.
That's
so
cool.
He likes to look at things that people think have no use and figure out, could they be useful? And so he was really interested in these porous molecular structures. And so in 92, he published his first one about having this two-dimensional material that could trap acetone. And he was trying to get funding to do more work. And people were like, really? Why? Like, are you really this useful? he kept going, and in 97 he made a three-dimensional structure that had these intersecting open channels that could actually now fill with gas. So it was kind of starting to maybe show it was a bit more use, and so but still not very stable. So they're not going to be long-lived. And then this is where Yagi came in, who his fascination with chemical structure had started like when he was 10 years old kind of thing. And he was interested in these. And so in 95, he published his first two MOFs, which were held – they were basically nets held together by cobalt or copper. But what was really exciting was his one of these was actually really stable. Like, you could heat it to 350 degrees Celsius and it didn't break apart. So this is going, you know, now we're starting to go, okay, well, this is stable. This is one of the big problems. And he was actually the person who first used the term metal organic framework. And then in 99, he made what's called MOF 5. And this has basically been the star of the MOF story because it was really stable. It has a really high surface area. So if you think, we keep talking about these things being porous, right? So if we think about the actual surface area, they have the area on the outside and the area within each of these pores. And so it's said that a couple of grams of this material has a surface area as big as a football pitch. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of space for things to get trapped. And then beyond this, then there's been flexible MOFs made, and there's hundreds and thousands of different MOFs in the literature for various things. And they've been more used small scale, but they are moving to mass production and commercialization, such that there's actually a company in New Zealand that I've found, looked up, Captivate Technologies, which has come out of the McDermott Institute, and they have a MOF called MUF16, and it's basically to capture CO2. And so I think in the next few years we'll just definitely start seeing a lot more of these on the market doing useful stuff for us.
Amazing. Our last one before we finish up is the physics prize.
Yeah.
This looks very cool. I don't know what any of these words mean. Macroscopic, quantum, mechanical tunneling.
Yeah.
So at least not together anyway.
Yeah, no, The physics one's always a little bit of a harder one to describe, I think, sometimes. Yeah. So this is interesting. And the other two, the three people weren't from the same group. They were, you know, like they were either very different, all three different labs, or there were two were at one lab and the other was another lab. This Nobel Prize has gone to three people that worked together. So there was John Clark, Michael Deverett, and John Martinez. One was actually a PhD student when they did the experiment.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So this is a bit wow. And it's, yeah, for the discovery of macroscopic quantum mechanical tunneling and energy quantization in electrical circuit. So what does that mean?
Wow.
So this is going to be a very surface layer of it. So quantum mechanics is the behavior of matter and energy at atomic or subatomic scales. So beyond what we encounter in our what we observe just in our everyday life, right? Quantum physics, they use the term microscopic when they are considering the atomic or subatomic particles. So these are things like electrons and such. You don't actually see them through an optical microscope. So the microscopic can become a little bit problematic term sometimes, but that's what it means. So we've got quantum mechanical out of that, quantum macroscopic quantum mechanical tunneling. Macroscopic is actually just when the phenomenon involves a large number of particles. So you're not just looking at one or two atomic or subatomic particles. So what's the quantum mechanical tunneling aspect of this? So if you think about, you have a ball, you throw it at a wall, the ball bounces back at you. That's kind of, it's a macroscopic system. It's classical physics. We know this, we observe this well, you know. But if we go to the quantum physics microscopic system and we think instead of a ball, we have an electron and our wall's just a thin wall, there's times where the electron will be on the other side of the wall. It's not bouncing back, it's on the other side of the wall. And this is what's called tunneling. And it's a bit bizarre, right? Like, how? Like, what? Yeah. And it kind of comes down to the fact that this analogy of quantum objects that we use, other than being tiny balls, it's not really, it falls down. So you need to just think about them as waves as well. And it's basically with these quantum objects is we can't say exactly where they are. We can only describe where they might be, so a probability of where they are in a space.
Right.
And so this is a thing, you'll hear this term wave function talked about a lot. And so what it means is when this wave function is high, it's got a higher probability of being in the space, and when it's low, it's a lower probability of being in the space. And it doesn't really, like, it doesn't, at the edges, it doesn't reach zero kind of thing, like it could be there. And so what kind of happens in this tunneling is that that wave function is kind of extended through our thin wall, and so the electron could just be on the other side of the wall.
Okay.
And so this is the tunneling, and it's been observed in the microscopic quantum physics scale and stuff. But what these Nobel Prize winners did was they managed to show it in a macroscopic. So in a system that had multiple quantum objects acting together kind of thing, which is, it isn't, it's been important. Why it's been recognized now, a lot of it I would say, is because it has been important for the development of quantum computers that are based on superconductors. So if you think about ordinary conductor material like a copper wire, current flows through it because the electrons can move through that wire, whereas a superconductor is, well, in the copper wire, you get resistance, right? It will heat up over time with that current going through. Superconductors, when they conduct electricity, they do it without resistance as long as they're below a certain temperature. And so why this happens is that basically you can think of the electrons kind of can push through, they become organized, and they basically think of it like a synchronized dance through the material. And so they can flow without resistance. And they effectively act as a single unit, so we can think of them as one quantum mechanical system. And what these Nobel laureates were able to do was to develop, to actually conduct this experiment that people have been trying, but it was a tough experiment to do. And they basically had two superconducting wires, they had a thin insulator in between, and they just observed it over time. And the idea was that if it was just superconducting like normal, you would see no voltage. But every so often they would see a voltage in that, and it was kind of this evidence that they were getting this tunneling effect in this macroscopic system. And then what they could also do was they irradiated their system with microwaves, like different wavelengths of microwave light. And sometimes you would get absorption, and so the system would move to a higher level. And so this is evidence that it's quantized, which is quantum mechanics. It's quanta, like, because it's these units of energy and stuff. And so this has led on to a lot of the development around some forms of quantum computing and such.
Amazing. Well, if anyone is interested in hearing more about these, the website for the Nobel Prizes is amazing. It's got such interesting content on there, and it's really interactive as well.
Yeah, no, I had actually, to be honest, I had never looked at that website before this year's Nobel Prizes, and I was really impressed.
It's very cool. That is everything for Dear Science today. Thank you so much
for coming in. Thanks.
Just a quick shout out for MOTAT. If you love all things trams, Live Day Trams is on at MOTAT this Sunday, the 19th of October. Check out their impressive collection and catch a ride on one of their steam trains. Not quite Nobel Prize, but nonetheless. Anyway, thank you so much for coming in, Kushla. Thank you, MOTAT. And as always, thank you, Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.